Welcome to Hepatocellular Carcinoma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. James Harding, and to begin, he talked about his experience with immune checkpoint inhibitors in patients with HCC.
I think with regard to checkpoint inhibitors in HCC, you know, we started with some of the initial clinical trials and in that way did treat a few patients with immune checkpoint inhibitors, namely the PD-1 blocking antibodies. And, you know, one of the first patients that I put on study had a rapid and dramatic response. This was a patient with fairly extensive HCC involving the peritoneal cavity, the liver, and received an anti-PD-1 antibody. And within 8 weeks, the tumors had reduced by like 70% throughout the body. And it was really an amazing rapid response. And what was really amazing about that was the patient had some toxicity after the first dose. And the scan 8 weeks later reflected one dose of an anti-PD-1 antibody with this dramatic shrinkage. And actually, this now continues 3 years later. This patient's still doing extremely well. And so I knew when I saw that response that clinically these drugs had import. I knew that, you know, the field would certainly be looking at this either alone in combination over the next several years, which it's been doing. And I do think it's a very exciting time for liver cancer, which, you know, prior to 2017, there was only one drug, and that was sorafenib.
So I'd say things got a lot more exciting in the last few months, and we're going to talk about that in a second. But I just want to ask about your patient. You said the patient had some toxicity. What kind of toxicity?
The patient had a transaminitis. So after the first dosing, we saw AST, ALT in the several hundreds. And this we know, and we see this with single agent anti-PD-1 antibodies, maybe about 10% or more will have some transaminitis related to treatment. Usually it's reversible. It's unclear, I think, if it's immune mediated, but often it is treated with steroids. And in his case, we did treat him with steroids because it was relatively early in the use of these antibodies. And, you know, his LFTs resolved and we rechallenged him off steroids and he's been on treatment for 3 years without recurrence of that toxicity.
Yeah, you know, am I correct in saying that maybe autoimmune hepatic toxicity is not necessarily more common in patients with HCC than other cancers, but maybe has a different clinical relevance because they already have liver disease? Is that the case, or is it more common?
Well, you know, I think that if you look at immune checkpoint inhibitors across solid tumors, they do tend to have clusters of toxicity. So, for example, when you're thinking about patients treated with lung cancer, I think there is a bit of a higher rate of pneumonitis. Whereas when you're treating patients with hepatomas and gastrointestinal cancers, perhaps we see a little bit more of immune-mediated colitis or transaminitis. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, although, you know, it's always a problem in lung cancer because a lot of times it's hard to figure out even what's going on if they have pneumonitis.
So, right.
Anyhow.
Which is true for liver cancer as well. I mean, a lot
right.
of these patients
of
have hepatitis C,
right.
hepatitis B, cirrhosis. So teasing out, you know, LFT abnormalities on a therapy is difficult. And generally, you know, when I see abnormalities in liver function tests, I will, you know, hold therapy and reassess, you know, I'll check viral loads for hepatitis, I'll reimage patients, and I'll make an assessment based on that as to whether I think it's drug-related, disease-related, or something related to cirrhosis.
Wow, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it from that point of view. It does seem like lung, though, because same thing. You got to rule out
right.
every other. Oh, that's really interesting. Okay.
You do.
I also want to reflect back on the ASCO GI meeting and what's been going on the last couple months. Just to stick with your original patient and the sort of original monotherapy checkpoint data, I was really fascinated by this comment. Let me read it to you because I thought it was really interesting. Quote, 30% of patients progress at 6 weeks. So you're talking about checkpoint inhibitors, I guess monotherapy. 30% progress at 6 weeks. 80% progress at 1 year. And 50% of responders lose the response at 1 year. So can you kind of reflect where we were once we had that initial data on monotherapy that caused you, and it's only, is that your sort of assessment yourself?
Yeah, so that's just looking at the published data from CheckMate 040 by Anthony El-Khoueiry, as well as published data for the pembrolizumab phase 2 in HCC published by Richard Finn. Clearly, immune checkpoint blockade, anti-PD-1 monotherapy has some level of activity. But that level of activity is relatively small. You know, only about 18 to 20% of patients will have a response to treatment. And by response, I mean a RECIST response. And of those, half of those responses are lost within a year based on the median duration of response. So what that means, I think, to me, is that the majority of patients are not mechanistically set up to respond to monotherapy. And when you look at the pivotal phase 3 data, the CheckMate 459 in the frontline setting versus sorafenib, and the KEYNOTE data versus placebo in the second line setting, both of those studies were negative, although there was some hint that perhaps the anti-PD-1 therapy, you know, was more favorable. Statistically, they were negative. And either that's because the therapeutic is not effective in the majority of patients, or related to trial design, unintentional crossover. But nonetheless, I think the field sense of this is that, you know, we need to do more to treat a general population of patients with HCC.
So I've got to tell you that as I heard this getting discussed over the last couple of years, I was sitting back there saying to myself, well, because I would say to people, would you give it first line? And they would say no. And I was sitting there going, you know, I think if I had HCC, I'd like to take my shot at being your patient, even though I know it's, you know, 5% or what it's whatever. But fortunately, I think that debate, which never exactly happened, isn't really relevant anymore, thank the Lord, because
I agree.
Things are different. It seems like this is kind of just the beginning of a new strategy. And like I said, we've seen it in RCC now, you know, with the axitinib combinations. Can you talk a little bit about the rationale for anti-angiogenics?
Sure. So, I mean, I think one thing is just empiricism, right? We know TKIs and anti-angiogenics work in the disease. We know that immunotherapy has some level of activity. And I think because of that, it's just reasonable to look at that together. But there is, I think, a biology behind it, a basic science that's emerging behind it. We know that when you block VEGF and associated pathways, it may have effects on the immune microenvironment. It could suppress suppressive cells. It may have effects on the vasculature that enhance T cell trafficking. And actually, you've seen some of these data in papers or correlative data related to renal cell. And so I think there is a very reasonable rationale scientifically to combine the two. And certainly, if you look at the clinical data, you know, frontline immunotherapy alone is a negative, but when we combine it with an anti-angiogenic, we see, you know, IMbrave150, which is a positive study. I mean, there's improvement in survival, progression-free survival, a higher objective response rate, and I think very importantly, it's very tolerable compared to sorafenib. And so, I mean, we already know that there are other combination strategies that are kind of on the launch pad or enrolling. So the LEAP-02 data, where we're waiting to see this, which is lenvatinib versus lenvatinib pembrolizumab in the frontline. There's the COSMIC 312, which is basically looking at atezo with cabozantinib versus a sorafenib and a single agent cabozantinib arm. And so these studies, these phase 3 studies, which are, you know, pivotal and will hopefully answer those questions, are really driven by that science of the potential of at least additive or synergistic benefit with these combinations. And so I think it is a very exciting time, and I'm very excited to see those data, and hopefully they'll read out soon.
Yeah, it just so happened that just at the time we were doing this symposium, we were about to execute a survey of 25 GI clinical investigators across the country. And we asked them, what's your first line therapy? And most of them said atezo-bev. Even when we put older patients when we started to factor in liver dysfunction, some of them started to back away, talk more about lenvatinib. How do you think that's going to play out? And what do we know about atezo-bev or this kind of strategy in patients with liver dysfunction?
Well, I think that this is really important. I mean, from the IMbrave 150 data, we know that it does appear safer than sorafenib. There's less grade 3, 4, 5 toxicity with the combination. There is a delay in clinical deterioration based on quality of life, and we heard those data at GI ASCO. So this, though, is selected to a very fit population, the Child's Pugh A, liver functionality, and also very robust patients. Most of these patients, as part of the trial, had to be in excellent physical shape. All of them had to have had a screening endoscopy at some point within the prior few months, assuring no active bleeding or concern for bleeding, as bevacizumab can certainly increase that risk.
Could I just ask you about that one factor? Because it kind of surprised me a little bit. I mean, normally, you know, for example, if you weren't giving Bev, you wouldn't be doing endoscopy, would you? And somebody who's not bleeding or anything?
Right. So what drove me, and I'm curious to see what others would do here, and I'm not sure how my practice will continue. It'll wait for the evolution of the data. But, you know, the original phase 2 study of bevacizumab that was led by Abby Siegel at Columbia, and this is reported, initially there were some upper GI bleeds, and the study had to be amended to basically screen patients for varices and to assure there wasn't a troubling risk or a higher risk of bleeding. And so I think for me, you know, the data are early and, you know, it's not yet an FDA-approved combination. I'd like to see a little more data on its safety in the cirrhotic, the bleeding risks as well, more data on that. And if I do treat patients which are off-label in select instances, you know, I'm very cautious about cardiovascular complication and bleeding risk from bevacizumab.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I was always like a little confused about the risk of Bev and bleeding, cardiovascular disease. I can never, even to this day, figure out, was this some kind of statistical thing or was it really
right.
Clinical? I mean, do you think you saw it clinically?
Well, you know, clinically, you do see certainly an increase. The population is at risk for hypertension, high-grade hypertension,
for sure.
And that is a common toxicity. We manage that well. You know, you see people, if you monitor, you'll see the emergence of proteinuria. You need to watch for that.
Absolutely.
It's very well known for bevacizumab, at least from the colon literature, that doing a surgery while on bevacizumab is complicated. There's poor wound healing, delayed wound healing. And so
for sure, but bleeding?
Bleeding, I have seen it, though the rates of that are relatively low. I would agree with that. But I think, you know, from my practice, I still would use caution with its application.
Absolutely.
And I would get my ducks in a row with
Absolutely.
Regard to cardiovascular health and potential bleeding risk.
Absolutely. As you say, particularly if you're in a situation where it's off-label, though it really is very compelling. And we're certainly not suggesting that people do anything off-label. You have to kind of make your own decisions, but the data seems quite compelling. And I guess the other thing is, so it kind of just seems like even, you know, particularly because endoscopy, I mean, it's unpleasant, but really not risky. And just to, I don't know, because they did it in the trial, I think that's enough of a reason to do it. So
yeah. I think if you polled enough oncologists, there would be a mix of what's important or not.
Trust me, we will be polling people. Well, that's really why I'm asking you, because my guess is I wonder whether we're still going to be doing endoscopies, let's say 2 years from now, you know, once we kind of have a lot more data. I don't know. Maybe we will.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, as we see how it applies to a more general population, as we see more follow-up data, and hopefully it is something that does become approved by regulatory authorities, we'll have a better sense of how to use it and in what population.
So you mentioned in terms of the IMbrave study, I guess those patients had adequate liver function. Right now, does that mean that you are not going to be using atezo-bev in somebody with liver dysfunction?
So the way I treat patients with advanced liver cancer, if you have a Child's Pugh C liver function, I often find that that is too advanced cirrhotic to treat. So for C, usually those patients are being accessed with best supportive care and, you know, co-management with a hepatologist to kind of maintain liver function and improve quality of life.
Because that's really their threat to survival.
Yes, the threat to survival is driven by the cirrhosis and the decompensated liver dysfunction. And for the Bs, you know, there it's harder to extrapolate. You know, we do have safety data already in hand for sorafenib in the B. We know that sorafenib is safe there. We know that for single agent immunotherapy, there have been prospective data from CheckMate 040 indicating safety, as well as several retrospective cohorts that have been published that appear for a B7 nivolumab or single agent anti-PD-1 therapy is safe. For the combinatorial approaches, there's less data for that I'm aware of. And I think we're going to need to see those data before applying it to the B, in my opinion.
So one thing also I'm kind of trying to figure out is objective response. And one of the things that got people excited, I think, is the fact that there is a pretty significant objective response. You describe a patient, I don't think you would have seen that with sorafenib ever,
right?
The patient. But on the other hand, when you actually look at the trial, I think the response rate was like in the 30s.
Yeah.
But they actually had sorafenib as like 10 or 15%. I didn't even know that ever caused responses.
Right. So, you know, for sorafenib, the objective response by RECIST, I mean, is low. I mean, it's generally around 2 to 5%. That's RECIST version 1.1, slightly higher if you use modified RECIST. But generally, it's viewed as a cytostatic agent. You know, single agent PD-1 has been operating at an objective response rate of about 15%. And then a lot of the combinations, the phase 3 I am brave is 30%, but other combinatorial strategies that are in phase 1 and 2 are up around 30%. And, you know, I think it's very important to see a response. It's important, I think, for patients. Symptomatically, patients generally feel better when their tumors shrink. But one thing that we've seen in the literature and at discussions for HCC and other solid tumors, it's not clear that response is the best surrogate for survival, right? We don't know that just by virtue of having a response or a high objective response rate, that will translate to an improvement in survival. And I mean, I think, you know, at least looking at the data for single agent anti-PD-1 therapy, you know, this had a 15 to 18% response rate, and we didn't see a positive study. And you could argue that could be due to the trial design, but, you know, another thing to keep in mind is that objective response rate is not a surrogate for the endpoint of overall survival.
In the I Am Brave study, sorafenib was 12 and 13% objective. That's what I thought was kind of high. Like, I never even heard of people responding.
Yeah. Well, I think this goes to show that objective response, I mean, it's hard to measure. It's not clear it's a surrogate for survival. And there's variability around it. I mean, so usually I quote for sorafenib between 2 to 12%, for lenvatinib, 20%+. For combination IO, at least from I Am Brave, it's about 30%.
I'll tell you why I was thinking about the issue of response rate. Okay, you know, 30% is not all that great, but, you know, still seeing patients like the one you describe. And that may be kind of a weird thing, but one of the things I thought about as I kind of was watching what people are doing is the issue of how people with liver-only disease are managed. Because what I hear from a lot of oncologists in practice is they can't get to the patient. The interventional radiologists are tasing them, et cetera. And I'm wondering, I mean, with sorafenib, you can't, I mean, I think that it's kind of a debulking procedure if you think about it conceptually.
Yeah.
So do you think that what we're going to see is these combinations being used rather than like TACE or local therapy?
Yeah. I think we're primed to have a shift in sort of the way we treat liver-limited HCC. I think it's clear for small volume liver-limited HCC, you know, so that's just outside of the transplant criteria. You know, I think embolization is a very reasonable approach and has been shown to have a survival benefit in several prospective studies. However, you know, when you look at those studies, it really was enriched with a smaller volume liver-limited disease. As you get to bulkier multifocal disease, I think it is unclear as to whether or not regional therapy has the same effect. I don't think we know that. Whereas for systemic therapy, we're certainly seeing now higher objective response rates than we've had before. We've seen improvement in survival. So I think it will be probable that we will start to see more activity at that earlier stage of disease, either alone with systemic combination or with potentials of embolization plus systemic therapy or regional therapy plus systemic therapy. So I think that's probably where the field is going to move, and we're very excited to see how, you know, it ultimately comes out. But there is a shelf life to serial embolization when somebody is far outside of the transplant criteria.
I mean, you know, HCC has always been different because, you know, the hepatologists are involved, interventional radiologists, kind of a different clinical model. But, I mean, maybe you could think about sort of neoadjuvant systemic therapy before local, because that's what you do in other cancers, right?
Yeah.
Pancreas,
right.
Breast, et cetera.
Well, yeah, and so there are several phase 1-2 studies now that are ongoing that are looking at combinatorial approaches with TACE, neoadjuvant studies.
Combined, you mean same time?
Same time combinations, but I'm pretty sure there are some that are now looking at even prior to TACE. I mean, we're running a study right now of TACE with nivolumab, which we presented, which demonstrated early safety. And, you know, I think that this was a study that we designed, you know, 5 years ago, and we know it's safe, but I think it primes the pump for larger phase 2 and 3 studies to look at, you know, combinatorial strategies in the B space, as well as potentially areas where you might try to displace embolization in the correct clinical context. I mean, I think the point that you're bringing up is for the B liver Barcelona criteria B, it's a huge variation of what we consider that. And I don't think it's very well delineated yet what is the best way to treat this very heterogeneous population. You know, a B liver is like 1 15-centimeter tumor or 15 1-centimeter tumors. So, you know, they probably need to be treated differently. And I think ongoing studies will hopefully clarify that for us.
I remember having the thought a couple of years ago when I first started hearing about checkpoint inhibitors about, I know it seems kind of strange, but combining therospheres and immunotherapy, like with the abscopal effect, has that ever been done?
So there are studies that are ongoing looking at that. There are phase 1-2 studies that people are looking at that. I think the abscopal effect is very interesting, where you have a local approach that leads to some change in systemic immunity, and that then helps clear distant metastatic disease.
I mean, it's standard of care. Locally advanced lung cancer now, non-small cell lung cancer, is chemo radiation followed by durvalumab.
Exactly.
I mean, whether that's really about the radiation, but I mean, they had pretty good results there, but who knows why.
Yeah, I think that that's possibly related to that. And I think we'll start to see more of that in the B space with liver cancer for sure. And I think that's partly where the field is going, all, of course, in an investigational context.
So I want to talk a little bit about your patient in terms of what happened. I don't think we have to go through all the details, but I am curious kind of how the patient presented and was diagnosed. This is a 50-year-old man, huh?
Yeah, so the first case was really a 50-year-old who had known chronic HBV, was on antiviral therapy, had excellent liver function with Child's Pugh A liver function. And basically, the patient had done initially screening for liver cancer as he was in a higher risk group, but was lost to follow up and basically presented to his primary care physician with constitutional symptoms, you know, sort of fatigue, maybe a new cough that prompted, you know, general workup with laboratories, which were mostly unremarkable. He did end up having a chest radiograph, which showed pulmonary nodules, which led to further cross-sectional imaging with a CT, three-phase liver, pelvis, and chest, which basically showed HCC by imaging characteristics. So multiple tumors within the liver, bilobar, as well as multiple pulmonary nodules. AFP was also elevated at that time, and he was then referred for further therapeutic considerations.
So I see that, I mean, the AFP was 10,000.
Yes.
So could you just comment? I know he got biopsied and had HCC, and he did have Mets. So I guess my question is, are there situations where you think it's not necessary to do a biopsy? And how often do you see Mets clinically at first diagnosis of HCC?
Yeah, so in answer to the need for a biopsy or not, I think there's still a lot of controversy as to whether or not one should biopsy HCC. We know from the transplant literature as well as early stage HCC, there's an excellent correlation between imaging characteristics to pathologic diagnosis, although that's not 100% complete. And, you know, it does make sense to me if you're planning to do a curative surgery or potentially a transplant or some curative therapy that, you know, you might want to forgo a biopsy because ultimately with the explant or the resection specimen, you'll know what it is. And this negates the risk of seeding or complications related to a biopsy. That said, as you get to more advanced disease and you're committing someone to a lifetime of systemic therapy and you know that there is probably a small chance of like a mixed histology, like mixed cholangio HCC or pure cholangio or other potential, you know, tumors, you want to be absolutely certain. And in my practice, I do biopsy patients that I'm planning to start a systemic therapy on because, you know, I think this is the gold standard. I think it also is useful to have that potentially for genomic analysis, although that is somewhat, I think, not yet defined. But nonetheless, I do biopsy, and I'd like to confirm metastatic disease that way. Most of the patients that I biopsy really are those that are fit for treatment. So if I think someone is not fit for treatment other because their cirrhosis is too bad or their performance status, then we really don't go that route and I might consider a best supportive care approach. But if I'm going to give a systemic therapy, I do obtain a tissue diagnosis. And admittedly, most trials do that as well as data from the United States. You know, there was a good analysis of VA patients getting sorafenib by Kim Rees-Binder at Penn. And I think in that population, about 80% of medical oncologists do get a biopsy, and I am in that camp. Though I can understand instances where people might not do that. And so, you know, in this case, he's firmly diagnosed as HCC. In terms of, you know, how do patients often present, I'd say that the majority of patients present with advanced liver-limited disease or metastatic disease, either into the portal vein or extrahepatic spread. I mean, the estimates, I think, probably about 70-80% of patients will actually present later in their course than at earlier curable stages of disease.
No, I was just curious how often you see a patient at first diagnosis with clinical metastases, not liver-only, unresectable, but, you know, he had lung mets. It seems unusual.
Yeah. So the metastatic pattern for liver cancer that we see, you could be perihepatic lymph nodes, adrenal mets, peritoneal carcinomatosis, bone mets, and lung mets. And so, you know, those are the organ systems where we do see mets. And I don't have the specific data based on review of that literature, but in my practice, I'd say it's at least 30% of patients that I see, maybe more, but we're a tertiary referral center. So I'd have to look more carefully at those data.
So I want to kind of get a little bit more into, you know, it's always fascinating to me how people react to new data. It's such a challenging situation. Oncologists are always so interested about what does it take to take action. So when you saw this man, first of all, I'm kind of curious, was he the kind of patient who was very, very involved, getting information, going on the internet?
Yeah, so, you know, this patient presented to me very well educated. It was a professional, was very aware of the landscape of treatment for advanced liver cancer.
And had the IMbrave 150 trial been presented at that point?
It had been presented, yes.
Wow.
So this was right following this.
Wow.
And so in his case, we discussed the two standard options at the time, which were sorafenib and lenvatinib. And we talked about lenvatinib extensively based on the REFLECT data. You know, we see there a high objective response rate, a PFS advantage over sorafenib, and non-inferiority to sorafenib. And certainly this was a reasonable approach and a standard approach, in my opinion, based on the current approvals. We did have knowledge of the IMbrave 150 data. And for this particular patient, he was very interested in an immunotherapeutic approach. We talked about the available data. We also acknowledged that, you know, we don't have long-term follow-up on these patients. We don't yet have a full understanding of toxicity. But ultimately, we did get this for this particular patient. And he began therapy and continues to take this therapy and has done relatively well with it.
Well, relatively well. Did he have an objective response?
Yeah. So we basically, you know, had some toxicities with regard to hypertension as well.
Had he ever been hypertensive before?
No.
Not on treatment?
But he developed hypertension while on treatment, which we treated. We treated him into his first scan, which showed a tumoral shrinkage. We saw a drop in the alpha-fetoprotein. And essentially, you know, we follow him now. It's relatively early, so it's hard to know, you know, how long this response will last, but a reasonable approach based on the emerging data.
Looks like his AFP went from 10,000 to 200.
Yes.
That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is, you know, from what we see with lenvatinib and others, I mean, so in my experience, and this is just clinical and anecdotal experience, oftentimes with objective response, we do see some decrease in AFP. And this is from clinical data, you know, just in terms of treating patients. When I see objective responses with single agent immunotherapy or with combinatorial approaches, I've often seen a decrease in AFP. And there are some ad hoc analysis of phase 3 data, like lenvatinib, for example, that suggests if you have an AFP response, you might do better. But I will say, as a practicing oncologist, the things that I care about most are, one, how is the patient doing? Are they clinically thriving? Are they improving? Two, what is the scan showing? I'm happy with at least stability or some degree of tumoral shrinkage. I then look at the alpha-fetoprotein. I try to use tumor markers less in the assessment of the disease. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, in terms of his imaging, did he have a partial response?
There was tumoral shrinkage. I did not calculate the degree to which that was, but it looked fairly substantial, yeah.
So how often do you see this with sorafenib or lenvatinib, incidentally? I guess lenvatinib, you see some responses, huh?
So lenvatinib, you know, I've had several patients, and this was sort of another case.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this other patient.
Yeah, so just in parallel to this, you know, I have a patient of several patients, but one that is an example, you know, of a gentleman, he's a bit older in his 70s, he had NASH-associated HCC, biopsy proven, mostly liver-limited disease, treated with embolization, ultimately developed some portal vein involvement, also had rheumatoid arthritis on sort of these disease-modifying agents and immunosuppressives. You know, I placed him on lenvatinib at the standard dose for his weight, and he had a very similar experience in that the tumor marker, which was elevated, decreased. He had stability to some shrinkage of the tumor with a decreased enhancement. So we see that with anti-angiogenics where the patients will have necrosis of the tumor, less enhancement of the tumor. This has been well documented with drugs like sorafenib, lenvatinib. These are non-classical responses where you don't necessarily have tumoral shrinkage, but you have central necrosis. And so that's another example of response. And he continues now with stable disease. And this is a patient that's been on for some time now, at least over 6 or 7 months.
So one thing I see here that's kind of interesting about this patient, well, a couple of things I want to ask you about. One is, you said NASH-associated cirrhosis, and I hear about that, but I'm kind of curious, though, how it manifests clinically. For example, was this patient obese?
So this patient has a history of obesity, also has some hypertension, cardiovascular comorbidities, and hyperlipidemia. And you often see that with fatty liver disease. And
is that the usual kind of clinical history when you have a NASH-associated HCC? That there's,
typically, they're not
like,
yeah.
So it's not like, you know, excessive morbid obesity and something clinically.
It doesn't have to be. That's one part of the criteria for sort of a metabolic syndrome, but you don't need to be morbidly obese. And certainly in the United States, we're seeing more patients with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And so, you know, there's probably going to be more NASH and maybe more liver cancer associated with that.
So one other thing about this case that's really interesting, this is a 70-year-old man that we're talking about who's on the lenvatinib, is that he has a history of rheumatoid arthritis controlled with DMARDS, which I don't even know what that is, but I guess it's a RA-type drug.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So does that mean you're never going to consider a checkpoint inhibitor, or would you?
Well, for patients that I'm treating, I mean, in the front line, you really want to treat patients with the best available agent and not necessarily exacerbate a co-occurring medical illness. And certainly there are a subset of patients with liver cancer that have forms of autoimmunity, whether that's affecting the liver predominantly, whether it's affecting another organ, Crohn's, colitis, or other immune-mediated diseases. You know, we do know from melanoma literature that if you try to treat these patients, you may increase the morbidity associated with the primary autoimmunity, and you may exacerbate that. And indeed, most, if not all, of the clinical trials that have looked at immune checkpoint inhibitors have really excluded patients with active autoimmunity. So you don't necessarily know if by giving it, you might not worsen that underlying condition. So I consider autoimmunity a relative contraindication to immune checkpoint inhibitors. It's not to say I might not consider it in certain instances, but I would do so with extreme caution and also, you know, with co-management by a rheumatologist or whoever is managing that autoimmune condition.
So I don't know when this man presented, but if you had been aware of the data of atezobev, or if somebody like this presents to you next week, would you give first-line atezobev with that history of rheumatoid arthritis?
No, I would not. I would steer away from immunotherapies right now. You know, I think, you know, the atezobev data and IMbrave150, it's super exciting. I think immunotherapy is certainly here to stay. We're going to be using a lot more of it. I'd say that we're still waiting for more data. And I am somewhat uncomfortable about treating patients with underlying autoimmunities when I know there is an alternative like lenvatinib that has a high objective response rate and is at least non-inferior to sorafenib based on the phase 3 REFLECT data.
So in talking about lenvatinib, we know the REFLECT study was the basis of the approval of lenvatinib as first-line therapy. But then the combination of pembrolizumab and lenvatinib has shown really promising activity. Seems like a safety profile is pretty good with HCC as well. In July of 2019, this combination got breakthrough designation by the FDA as potential first-line treatment based on the results of the KEYNOTE-524 study. As you mentioned earlier, the ongoing phase 3 LEAP-002 trial is comparing pembro lenvatinib versus lenvatinib alone as first-line therapy of HCC. What I've been hearing about in terms of lenvatinib pembrolizumab in general from a toxicity point of view is it seems like it's mainly related to the lenvatinib, that maybe there's not a lot of synergy there. It's just you're dealing with the toxicity of lenvatinib.
I think that, you know, what's going to be interesting over the next 6 months to year is to see all of the combination data. And if all of them are positive, that would be wonderful. And then it will be a matter of the degree of toxicity, and that will decide, you know, how you choose and what you choose. I mean, the initial data for liver cancer of levopembro, it did show that there was grade 3-4 toxicity related to lenvatinib, some IO toxicity. And so it's going to be interesting as we see it in larger data sets, how much is that and how does it compare to single agent? I think that's going to be the key. Probably the agents that give the least toxicity, best quality of life, assuming that all else are equal in terms of outcomes, would probably be the preferred. But we have to see those data.
And it is going to be really interesting as these data roll out. But also is going to be the data, and it's not uncommon in oncology to have things with similar efficacy, different tolerability. And that brings in the question of, and when you add an anti-angiogenic partner, are you going to see less problems with something like Bev or even, I don't know, ramucirumab? I don't know whether they've looked at that versus a TKI.
So there are studies looking at that, yeah. So, there are definitely studies looking at Ram plus IO. Those are in phase 1-2. So it will be very interesting to see how it plays out with TKI IO plus anti-angiogenic targeting VEGF IO. And those data, we have to wait and see. It's hard to know right now. I think another relevant issue is that there's also co-targeting CTLA-4, which we haven't discussed. But there, we definitely have, you know, two studies that are coming out now. Himalaya, which is a very large global study that my colleague Ghassan Abu Alfa has been very involved with. And this, you know, basically looked at tremelimumab plus durvalumab at two different dosing schedules versus durvalumab versus sorafenib. Primary endpoint is OS from the sorafenib to the combination arm. So we wait to see those data. Also, the ipilimumab plus nivolumab, we've seen preliminary data from the CheckMate 040 study. There, the objective response rate, looking at three cohorts. The cohorts dosed the ipi-nivo differently, but all of the cohorts in that CheckMate 040 study showed an objective response rate of 30% and some favorable median overall survival data. And based on that, there is a randomized phase 3 of ipi-nivo versus a dealer's choice sorafenib-lenvatinib that's ongoing now. And so these will be other key, I think, points for the future. It's unclear, you know, we need to see the data to know where we stand, but it's certainly a very exciting time for liver cancer.
And, you know, getting back to this, HCC is the new RCC. Obviously, ipi-nivo is a huge issue in RCC as well. And the same situation that you don't necessarily see phase 3 comparing anti-CTLA-4 anti-PD-1 versus anti-angiogenic PD-1. I don't know if there are phase 3s out there. It seems like they're kind of in different segments of development.
Oh, looking at the combo of combo IO versus IO anti-angiogenic.
Yeah, right.
That would be very interesting to see. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you want the most bang for your buck. You want, you know, the longest survival, the best objective response at the minimal amount of toxicity. And I think over the next year to two, we're going to see what the data are for all of these frontline approaches. And based on what they are, we're going to have to determine the best way to treat these patients. And for me, it will definitely be, you know, we want to maximize quality of life and minimize toxicity for sure. And I don't know which one of these approaches is going to do that in the absence of the data.
I think what I'm hearing about HCC is, I'm not sure indirectly there's any reason to think that something like anti-CTLA-4 PD-1 is going to be less effective than, say, anti-angiogenic PD-1. I mean, it might be, but I get more concerned about maybe it's going to be more toxic.
Yeah, so I think your point's well taken. Based on the preliminary phase 1-2 data, they seem to be performing in a similar fashion in terms of objective response rates as well as survival and outcomes. Now, of course, it's, you know, cross-trial comparisons and early data. It's really hard to make definitive statements either way. And I agree with you that assuming all of them are equal, you know, what's going to make the most, I think, to patient care will be toxicity and quality of life. And so far, single-agent TKIs seem to have a higher toxicity than an IO plus anti-angiogenic monotherapy like Bev, right? We see that from the IMbrave 150 data. And it's unclear how co-targeting PD-1 and CTLA-4 versus co-targeting PD-1 and a TKI, how much toxicity there will be. I think the combination IO, certainly we know that when you add an anti-CTLA-4 blocking antibody, you increase the rate of immune-mediated adverse events. And hopefully that will be tolerated, but perhaps it won't be tolerated in the cirrhotic. And these are the data that we need to see before we make any firm conclusions.
So I'm curious, I mentioned that if, in fact, as has really happened in renal, you see a complete flip in first-line therapy, then it affects what comes next.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, right, we don't have data, like in breast cancer, we don't have data after CDK in a lot of the older studies.
Right.
So some of these studies, you know, we didn't have these combinations. So I wanted to bring up the issue of cabozantinib in the relapse setting, both now and in this new phase, and hear about your 70-year-old man who got treated, because I was kind of curious about how it's playing out toxicity-wise. And also, you mentioned the cabo-atezo first-line trial, and I'm curious how you think that's going to play out clinically, but also efficacy-wise, because cabo is a different drug. It has a different spectrum. You know, I don't know whether it'd be better or not as good as maybe another strategy. I was also thinking, you know, maybe a couple years from now, I'm going to say, is CRC the new HCC? Because colorectal cancer, we've got nivolumab regorafenib. I don't know if you're
right.
You know, I mean, that's just early and all, but it's the same strategy. Angiogenic TKI. Right. I mean, whether it's going to work or not, I don't know, but some people are kind of curious about it.
Yeah. So right now in the second line, the FDA available drugs are regorafenib after failure of sorafenib, cabo after failure or intolerance to sorafenib, and ramucirumab in patients with elevated alpha fetoprotein. And those three drugs are approved based on phase 3 data that showed an improvement in overall survival. Those drugs, as you note, have not been tested after lenvatinib or after an IO combination. And so when we move to the second line at this time where there's a lot of new data, it is hard to choose what is the best second line choice. Another thing that complicates it, some have said that, you know, are we going to view atezo bevacizumab as your pre-first line and then move everything that's now first line beyond, like lenvatinib, then to cabo? I don't know.
Well, here's another one. And, you know, we just ask people. We present scenarios and we ask 25 people what you do. And I was mentioning this survey we did. And one of the, I don't know if I'd say shocking, but, you know, interesting thing was we saw a lot of people saying atezo bev second line after TKI.
Yeah.
Do you do that? Yeah. Or would you do that?
I have not done that yet. I can see why someone might consider doing that. But it's hard really to say from a purely evidence-based medicine perspective, what is the best case in that scenario? Typically for patients that I treat with a TKI, if I had a TKI in the frontline setting, I typically move to a TKI in the second line setting, assuming that it was very well tolerated. I use rego, cabo, I've used ramucirumab all in, you know, different patient populations. In the case that we provided here, you know, this was a patient that did relatively well on sorafenib for 6 months, had stability of disease, stability of sort of all, you know, vital function, but then progressed.
What dose of sorafenib was he on?
So this patient was relatively fit, honestly, and I did start at 400 BID initially and some titrate up the dose of seravenib, but in this case, I felt he did relatively well. He did have hand-foot syndrome and diarrhea, and I did ultimately reduce the dose to 200, and he ultimately progressed.
I kind of want to see if we could focus on the decision after he progressed on seravenib teaching point of view, okay? So
sure.
I guess what I wanted to do is just say, you know, if we were going to design a survey and we did a case like this, 70-year-old patient gets seravenib for 6 months, requires dose reduction, then has disease progression, what would be the options theoretically that you might consider in a patient like this today?
Well, so in this particular case, since he tolerated frontline serafinib well with only one dose level modification with extended stable disease, he would fit within the category of either getting regorafenib or cabozantinib. His AFP was less than 400, so he would not be a candidate for ramucirumab.
And just from a clinical point of view, putting aside reimbursement and access, et cetera, what about a checkpoint inhibitor, and what about a checkpoint inhibitor / anti-angiogenic like atezo-bev in a situation like this?
So I think in terms of the single-agent checkpoint inhibitors, I think that would also still be reasonable. Purists and sort of hardliners within the field see the pembro versus placebo data as negative. It is a negative study. It didn't meet its primary endpoint. And whether that's because of some statistical design, whether it's because of unintentional crossover, some will say negative is negative. And thus, when you're presented with a patient, you want to give them the, you know, not having some biomarker to select who's going to respond to an immunotherapeutic, one approach might be to say, well, they tolerated a TKI. We know from a population-based perspective, they respond to a second-line TKI, improves overall survival, and that's what we're going to use. On the contrary, there are others that would say that, you know, it wasn't a positive study, but it was very close. There was a high objective response rate. We know a subset of people do respond very well to immunotherapeutic. And, you know, I know there isn't a statistically proven survival advantage, but I might try that. And so I think the second line IO may become less of a question if more people adopt the frontline IO, right? If you have a frontline IO and you progress on it, I think it's unlikely that you'd get a single agent IO in the second line. For those people that get a TKI up front, the question I think becomes if they, you know, in my practice, I think if they tolerated it very well, they had a response, I might just switch because, you know, we know that when you treat somebody with an anti-angiogenic like serafinib, there's upregulation of MET. Cabozantinib targets similar proteins to serafinib, but also MET. You know, maybe it makes sense to give that at progression in that subset. And that's why I chose cabozantinib there. Does that help clarify for you?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I think also regorafenib would be reasonable as well based on the data. Though if, just to change the scenario, if this patient tolerated serafinib poorly, was not able to get on 400 milligrams for at least a month, that would have excluded them from the Rego trial, but not the Cabo trial, and thus I would choose Cabo. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, but I do think it's interesting that you consider that a patient, quote, tolerated serafinib well when they required a dose reduction, because everything is relative in this world. And
it's all relative.
You know, we've
it's
been living with serafinib for a long time, and everybody knows the challenges and at least to have some options. From your point of view, tolerability-wise, I see that this patient had some hand-foot syndrome with cabozantinib, some hypertension, required some dose reduction.
Yeah.
Globally, from your point of view, how did he clinically tolerate the drug?
Yeah. So looking from the data, you know, people are three times more likely on Cabo to have some AE than on placebo. And that's stated in the New England Journal of Medicine abstract. So it definitely adds toxicity. You know, I've seen anorexia, diarrhea, mucositis, hand-foot syndrome, weight loss as being the primary side effects. And in general, in my practice, I do try to manage grade 1-2 events with supportive medications, but grade 3 or higher is supportive medications and a dose reduction. I'd say say about half of my patients will require a dose reduction of the cabozantinib, and that's consistent with what we saw from the data. So, you know, it is tolerable, but does require dose reduction.
You know, there's one thing to look at clinical trial data, and it's another thing to talk to people who've taken care of a lot of patients, at least a lot more than general oncologists. And I'm just kind of curious, I mean, it's kind of a, you know, question, it's just really a kind of global question, but just in terms of the way some of these agents affect quality life in general. Like when you sit down with a patient, you know, to me, you can think to yourself, okay, well, you're not going to have any problems whatsoever. It's going to be like taking a placebo. You're going to have some problems, but, you know, we'll be able to figure it out and you'll be okay, or you're going to really have problems. And what I'd like you to do is just sort of in your mind, I know it seems kind of weird, but can you compare the TKIs? Because the one that I have the most question about, well, first of all, I wonder about cabo versus sorafenib or cabo versus regorafenib. Again, quality of life. But the real one I wonder about is lenvatinib, because, you know, hypertension to me, theoretically, is kind of a paper toxicity. Do these people feel bad?
So I would say that my experience with tyrosine kinase inhibitors is that, you know, the toxicity is real. People do feel that they're on a medicine. It's unusual that I have someone say to me that I feel like 100% myself. There usually is some clinical consequence of TKI-based treatment. In my experience in having given lenvatinib, sorafenib, cabozantinib, regorafenib, I do think that the lenvatinib toxicity is less apparent clinically. You don't see as much hand-foot. You don't see as much mucositis. You don't see as much diarrhea. It has been more mediated by sort of fatigue and hypertensive issues rather than those other symptoms. So as a TKI, I do happen to think that lenvatinib is a very reasonable thing to do based on that difference in toxicity. I would say that, you know, a lot of the times, and this is anecdotal, you know, when I've had patients on a TKI, they come off the TKI and I move to maybe a single agent immunotherapy, a lot of the times they say, wow, doc, I feel a lot better. You know, I feel much better on a single agent immunotherapy than I did the TKI. And sometimes I clinically think it's because they're going to respond. Then I get the scan and they didn't respond. And it's just indeed that I removed something that had a higher rate of adverse events and they're reconstituted from that. And it's not necessarily because they're having clinical benefit from the second or third line single agent IO.
Interesting. So let's just close out. You had a couple of unusual, interesting cases I'm curious about. Without getting into a lot of detail, you have this 78-year-old patient who had some type of myasthenia gravis syndrome related to checkpoint inhibitors. I've kind of heard a little bit about stuff like that. What happened with her?
Well, so this case, you know, the reason why I want to put it in is because just for a single agent IO or IO in general, you just have to be mindful of potentially very serious autoimmunity or immune-related adverse events. Much of the time, there are things that we can manage, but sometimes there is a really serious event. And, you know, I was actually, this was a patient that was being treated by another physician who was kind of scheduled to see me in clinic. And the patient told me that while driving, it was getting harder to see and hold their neck up, harder to swallow. And, you know, on the exam, you could see like the lids were drooping. It was hard. You know, there was weakness in the neck. And I actually was very concerned about that and admitted the patient to the hospital. You know, the patient had an extensive neurologic workup, and the differential was a sort of a myasthenia gravis versus sort of a myositis in the upper central muscles. And in any event, was treated with high-dose steroids and had recovery over several weeks to months. But, you know, we were concerned about potential respiratory compromise, airway compromise. And I think it's an example of one of these rare toxicities that can happen to any organ system that we see with immunotherapeutics. I mean, we have reports of cardiomyopathies, myositis, blindness, hepatic injury. These are rare, but I think it's very important that, you know, clinicians are aware of these toxicities and have a low threshold to evaluate them very carefully and also to start steroids. And I also think it's important because, you know, I see these patients every day, I treat them all the time, and we're at a referral cancer center that's primed to deal with this. But sometimes a patient like this might present to a local hospital in the emergency room, and, you know, they almost need a risk bracelet to say, listen, I'm on immunotherapy. Consider that when you're thinking about what could be wrong with me.
Yeah, no, I'm dying to do a series for emergency room docs. I keep hearing this all the time, how they're not
aware. Oh, yeah, that would be great.
And, you know, the other thing I'm kind of curious with this patient, anything that the neurologist could tease out about a prior history, do you think this was subclinical myasthenia before?
Right. So that's possible. I think that there are neurologists and neuro-oncologists that are actively looking into this area. You know, when you see these rare autoimmunities, is it that there was something subclinical that was missed? Possibly. Another suggestion that I've heard is that, you know, a lot of the times there are paraneoplastic syndromes that occur with cancer. And is it possible that we're unmasking some of these with our immunotherapeutics? How do we know who this is going to happen to? I don't think we know those answers, but certainly with the advent of immune checkpoint inhibitors, it's probably built in a new field into rheumatoid arthritis and oncology in general, looking at these toxicities, understanding why they occur, and perhaps identifying in advance who they might happen to is very important.
So I want to ask you just briefly about your last case, and it's incredible nowadays to be in oncology. I'll tell you that actually a few weeks ago, I had two different interviews that I did with investigators, different tumor types. Both of them had people who came out of hospice on a checkpoint inhibitor. It looks like you have one too, and I always love those. I just hard to even believe to think about, so what happened?
Right. Well, this was a really fascinating case. This was a case from a few years ago, and essentially I was treating an elderly woman with HBV-associated HCC, widespread metastatic disease throughout the liver. And at the time, this was when we really only had sorafenib as a frontline TKI, and there were compelling data for nivolumab. And, you know, she had a lot of cardiac comorbidities, very poorly controlled hypertension. Her blood pressure was, it still is, in the 160s, 70s, 80s. She did not speak English as a primary language, very hard to manage hypertension. And with discussion with the family, we made the decision to just treat with nivolumab, given the favorable safety data at the time, given the objective response rate, given the patient's kind of wish to do something to treat the cancer. And I gave the nivolumab for 6 to 8 months, but really I wasn't able to dose it very frequently because the patient, you know, had comorbid issues that complicated things. She had some falls, and the scans basically showed progression of disease, rising AFP. And at the end of this, like 6 to 8 months, I said, you know, I don't think I'm helping you. You know, your cancer seems like it's slowly getting worse. You're coming in frequently to try to get this medicine. You don't really have the performance status to do this anymore. It doesn't seem like your diminution in performance status is related to the disease. But nonetheless, you know, I think it's best if we hold treatment and we even consider best supportive care. You know, she had things that she wanted to do, and she decided to kind of enroll to hospice. And then I always have a follow-up visit a few weeks after I start hospice just to make sure everything kind of went well, that they got set up. And I happened to check labs, and her alpha fetoprotein, which was like 200,000, had dropped to 10. I mean, it was crazy. And this happened after I sent her home. So I had to call the patient's family member, and I said, listen, you know, I mean, this is a substantial drop. Would you mind if we brought her back and just checked on the disease? And we did, and it shrunk, and it's been shrinking now ever since that time. So she continues with, you know, geriatric follow-up, medical management. I see her every few months with the AFP and scans, and, you know, she's doing very well. I mean, she still has other issues, but she's living her life, and I think this was an interesting idea of sort of a delayed response or abnormal kinetics of response. hard to know how frequently this happens with immunotherapy. I think it's probably a low frequency, but I can't really attribute it to anything else at this point. So it's just kind of a fascinating story and something to keep your mind out. I mean, I do think it's a low likelihood of this, but I do think that this can occur. And I've heard other cases like this.
So she was on treatment for 8 months, was progressing, had the treatment stopped, and then had a response.
Yeah, I treated her for about 8 months with prior nivolumab. And what had happened was she had had a fall and she fractured her sacrum, which diminished her mobility. And basically, you know, the disease kept getting worse. And so I stopped treatment. And I think it's a very rare case, but I can't necessarily attribute the shrinkage to anything else. I mean, it was a significant drop in alpha-fetoprotein and significant shrinkage of the tumor. Some people suggest that, you know, there could be other reasons for this. You know, you see on placebo, for example, patients sometimes having an objective response. I don't know if this fits into that category, but certainly we have to consider these things now, the idea of pseudoprogression, the idea of delayed responses, the theoretical of hyperprogression. These are all things that are floating around when we take care of these patients, and I don't think we have all of the answers yet, but it's certainly interesting.
Well, I have a closing theory about your patient. How about this? How about if she actually ended up getting combination therapy because the nivolumab was still on board and she took some kind of supplement or something that synergized with it?
So, you know, I think that's a good question. I really asked very aggressively, are you taking any supplemental medicine? I asked very frankly, I said, listen, I'm not going to be offended if you went to another doctor and started another treatment. Please be honest with me because I think this is fascinating. And, you know, I've known her now for 2 years. I mean, like somewhere around that time, a little less. But she was very honest and she says she hasn't taken anything. So I agree. It's possible there could be some other thing at play. But I put this in as being a little more provocative in the sense of, you know, we have to acknowledge there may be a small proportion of patients that have pseudoprogression or a delayed response kinetics. We have to acknowledge as well that there might be something called hyperprogression where cancers may grow faster on this. So this is all kind of in there. None of this has been proven by any means, but something that I think clinicians should be aware of to think about at least.